Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. And so, ladies and gentlemen, it has come down to this. As if those of us who knew why we had to leave the European Union would not one day see this coming. As if we did not warn of the authoritarian nature of European Union rule. As if we didn't tell you so. Well now, ladies and gentlemen, it is very clear what is actually going on out there. The mask has well and truly slipped and the fangs have now been exposed. Rather like that scene from Alien I was just describing to Julia Hartley Brewer. You know the one where Sigourney Weaver's standing there in that huge, horrible kind of gaping jaw opens and the teeth are about to envelop her entire head. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the European Union, right? We know the wolf has now cast off its sheep's clothing, and what is standing before us is a pretty unedifying sight. Who knew that the unelected bureaucrats of the EU would put their own demagoguery before the lives of its own people? Who could have predicted that a former Cypriot psychologist, now grandly referred to as the EU's health commissioner, would threaten Britain with a block on receiving vaccine doses to save lives just because their own arrangements have been proved to be so completely and utterly useless? Make no mistake, the reason the EU is in trouble and lagging way behind the UK in the vaccine rollout is entirely due to their incompetence, their over-regulation and downright bureaucracy. Now they're proving to be nasty as well. What an absolute horror show. We'll be seeking the approval and the opinion of Labour leaver Brendan Chiltern. 0344 499 1000 is the number. We're also joined coming up by Dr. Simon Clark for an update on what looks like the falling COVID infection numbers and an explanation of what the different vaccines will do. Coming up later, we'll be taking a peek across the border to ask Kevin McKenna what on earth is going on in the Nicola Sturgeon Alex Salmond affair and what does it mean for the SNP? And as ever, we want to hear from you too. What are you hearing from your schools, from your work and from your friends? Could we really be looking forward to some kind of easing of restrictions in February? 0344 499 1000. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. Is it any wonder it is Talk Radio?
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
So you will have awoken this morning to the dreadful news, front page of the Times, warn us before jabs go to Britain, EU tells Pfizer. Basically, in a fit of pique, the European Union has decided that they're getting so few vaccines and they're managing to roll out so few vaccines because they didn't organise themselves as well as this government in this country did with Boris Johnson at the helm and Matt Hancock. You know, we've given them plenty of hard times for not doing things right. What they have got right is the vaccine rollout, and we should be very, very happy that we've got Boris Johnson in charge of this country and not the European Union, because if we had, we wouldn't be getting as many vaccines out there as we have done. We wouldn't be hitting the targets of 6 million, 7 million, 8 million as they're going to be going. Instead, we'd be sitting around waiting for the EU to kind of grant us the drippings from the rich man's table. Absolutely extraordinary. So as far as the EU is concerned, they are putting lives ahead of anything else, so that they're saying, you know, it doesn't really matter if you don't get vaccines. We are telling you that we may block the export of certain vaccines from the European Union into Britain. If you want to save lives, that's tough. Marvellous. What a great message. Let's talk to Brendan Chiltern, CEO of the Independent Business Network. Brendan, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
Not at all. I mean, I don't think I'm over-egging the pudding here to suggest that the EU is really proving itself to be a pretty nasty neighbour.
Well, absolutely. And even The Guardian have taken a critical tone this morning, so it must be true. I mean, it really is quite extraordinary. And it actually demonstrates what the benefits of having a nation state are in charge of our vaccine rollout rather than a supranational organisation. It's too big. It's too bloated. It can't adapt and respond to individual nations' needs. And so what's it doing? It's blocking. It's being protectionist. And this is exactly why the United Kingdom decided to leave. Now, I'm no fan of the government, as I'm sure you could appreciate. I'm a Labour member.
Yes.
But actually, to be fair to them, they've rolled the vaccine out. And we've got one of the highest vaccination rates, not just in Europe, but in the whole of the world. My dear old grandmother had it the other week. So I'm delighted it's being rolled out. Mm. But it just shows us we were right last year. And we should never rejoin the bloc.
No, absolutely. And this is, you know, as they say in sort of philosophical circles, you don't really find out what people are really like until you're in a bit of a crisis with them and you see how they behave. And if this is how they're going to behave, when they talk about, for example, rolling out the vaccine fairly, but then in the same breath, they talk about vaccine nationalism. It's almost as if they've got this kind of obsession with individual countries and the problem being individual countries when they don't actually see that the problem is their bloc.
Absolutely right. I mean, the European Union is hundreds of millions of people in population, so many different countries, so many different territories. It's almost impossible for them to roll out a uniform system of vaccination. What they should have done is said, look, this is something best handled at the nation state level, because you've got huge countries like Germany with a population of 80 million, and then right down countries like Austria with a population of 6 million. Mm. Austria is covered in mountains, Germany is relatively flat. It's far more difficult to deal with these different countries because they are so unique. And this is why supranational models of government like the European Union do not work, because they cannot adapt and cannot relate to individual circumstances in individual countries. It's like the old Soviet Union applying one model to all when they're so diverse, it just can't work.
Well, exactly. And I'm told that one of the reasons that they were so slow in getting the vaccinations organised was partly because of their over-regulated market system, and partly also because they were concentrating on the price of the vaccine rather than actually getting it to people.
Well, again, Mike, it was ever thus. I mean, we had the debacle a few weeks ago of the French shutting their borders to their own lorry drivers that were stuck in the UK. It just shows you what the European Union is like. Mm. And you're absolutely right. Their over-regulated, over-costed system of doing things is delaying the safety and well-being of citizens of the European Union. And I hope that citizens in those countries will wake up and smell the coffee on this and realise that actually outside of this bloc, which is operating in its own interests, not concerned about the health of the population, it's concerned about the European Union showing face and looking good, because they've had an appalling record on delivering the vaccine to their populations. And so this is really just demonstrating to leavers what we already knew, and to remainers in this country who are still fighting and want to go take us back, that actually we're better being in command of our own destiny and in control of our own vaccine programme.
Absolutely. And also, how arrogant of them as a group of individuals who are never elected to any job at all, these commissioners, right, starting to dictate to companies, multinational companies, no less. I mean, what sort of a message does that send to any company that might want to settle itself inside of the EU? Oh, sorry, you can't. Well, if you want to come and have a company in the EU, we'll be the ones telling you what you'll be able to do and what you won't be able to do.
Well, quite right. I'm sure this health commissioner is a very lovely lady, but I hadn't heard of her till this morning.
No.
And now all of a sudden she's got this massive power to determine who gets vaccinated and who doesn't, yet she's not had a single vote cast in her name. At least over here, if we don't like our government, we can remove them. Mm. But over there, the poor people of Europe are stuck with these incompetent people. And you're absolutely right. What message does it send to international business, to investors and to competitors, that in the middle of a crisis, which the whole world is engulfed in, although I'm opposed to lockdowns, the virus is a real thing and we've got to combat it. What message does it send to the world that the European Union's immediate instinct is protectionism? It's build walls, it's put restrictions on, when we should all be cooperating together, whether you're inside the EU or outside the EU. And they've really shown their true colours on this.
They really have, because it looks petulant, it looks petty, and it looks pathetic. You know, three P's to the EU, as far as I'm concerned. Because in the end, you know, I'm not even sure that they've got the power to control multinational companies in this way. I mean, what if Pfizer just said, well, I'll tell you what, if that's the way you want to play it, we'll just leave the EU altogether and we'll go and set up shop in Britain.
Well, I think that's quite right. And of course, President Macron this year is facing a difficult set of elections in France. Mm. And the French have got one of the poorest levels of vaccination. And I'm pretty sure that within a few weeks, or probably even today, the palace in Paris, where the president lives, is raging because he wants to vaccinate his population, yet he's being told from someone who is above him that he can't. Mm. Similarly, Chancellor Merkel is facing problems in Germany, growing discontent at the lockdown measures, and she needs to get her population vaccinated. Are these big, powerful countries, France and Germany, going to sit by and allow some piddly little commissioner in Brussels to dictate to them when they can get their vaccine rolled out? I think it's extraordinary.
And things are looking a bit dicey over in Amsterdam and Holland as well, aren't they? There's riots sort of spreading from city to city, anti-lockdown riots. They put a curfew on. The authorities are spraying people with water cannon. You know, Europe doesn't look like a very sort of solidly peaceful place at the moment.
No, quite right. And there have been some very alarming videos going around on social media over the weekend and yesterday. I think it's in Holland, of policemen aggressively hitting young people sitting down in parks with batons. I mean, this is a real issue for those of us that believe in liberty and freedom and civil rights, that across not just Europe, but we've had examples of it here, perhaps not to that level of aggression. And there's also been examples in the United States of the authorities clamping down on individuals' right to protest, an individuals' right to object, and as you guys have experienced at Talk Radio, an individual right to have an opinion. A combination of big government and big tech is not really one that's satisfactory for the future. And we need, as a society, I think, to seriously examine the powers of the state, the powers of big tech, and establish new norms for how we can all engage as free citizens in the future.
Yeah, and it's very interesting as well, since this story has obviously exploded across our media this morning, the EU are kind of backpedaling a bit. They put up some Irish MEP that I heard on a radio station earlier today talking about how these are just negotiations and this is just the normal practice of making sure that, you know, the company fulfills its contract, blah, 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 blah. Well, actually, no, this is the way that protection rackets operate. You threaten people with something so that they do what you want.
Yeah, well, we should perhaps rename her the Don or something, this health commissioner. We'll wake up with, it won't be a horse's head, it'll be a sort of empty needle in the bed.
That's
next morning.
Yeah, but it is extraordinary, isn't it?
It is absolutely extraordinary. And I think really what this is, it's a bunker mentality. The European Union, as a collective, have abject failed in rolling out the vaccine across the EU member states. You've got small countries like Israel, you've got us in Britain, the United States, all pulling ahead, getting our populations vaccinated. And this is basically EU trying to blame other people because they have failed, which is what they always do. It's never the fault of the European Union that we have a migration crisis in Europe. It's never the fault of the European Union that the southern states of the EU are poorer because of the imposition of the euro. It's not the European Union's fault that Britain had enough and voted to leave. They're never prepared to take responsibility. And really, at some point, they're going to have to. Because the citizens of Europe have suffered just as much as we have with lockdowns and their economies, and they're going to need to recover. And if the EU continue to delay the rollout of the vaccine, the longer it's going to take to get the economies of Europe back up and running. So there are some serious issues here, and the EU's got a lot of questions to answer.
Exactly right. And I mean, as far, I'm not expecting you to be knowledgeable of international law in all areas, but I mean, I'm not even sure that this question of telling Pfizer that you'll need to get permission effectively before you can export anything, I'm not sure there's any legal grounds for that.
I can't imagine there would be. I mean, they are supplying this vaccine, not just to the European Union, but essentially to the whole world. And I don't think the whole world will simply stand by and say, OK, European Union, you can impose these rules and regulations on this company to the detriment, not just of Britain, but to the rest of the world. I can't see that happening. I can't see President Biden, who's got a plan to vaccinate 100 million Americans within 100 days, sitting by and allowing that to happen.
Right.
And hopefully, in the course of international relations, this will demonstrate to the Americans that their true friends in Europe are, in fact, the British and not necessarily the European Union.
No. Well, the European Union, who clearly will have to now look at all of the various different countries, as you said, which all have very different needs, very different populations, very different just geographies, apart from anything else, never mind different languages and all the rest of it and different health systems. You know, they're going to have to work out, presumably, in their tiny minds exactly which order people should be getting the vaccines in. Because in this country, we only have to worry about the order of people getting it, i.e. individuals, vulnerable people, the elderly, people working in social care, people working in healthcare, people working on the front lines of dealing with the public. They're going to have to presumably work out some kind of very complicated matrix which says, should the people of Italy get it before the people of Croatia? You know, should Spain get more than France does? I mean, it's a nightmare for them.
It is. And of course, they're having to deal with, you know, situations where you've got islands as small as the little Greek islands to the high Alps of Austria and northern Italy, the much older populations in northern Europe compared to southern Europe. It's a right old mess. Mm. And for the European Union, instead of being flexible opening, saying just get the damn thing out there and vaccinate people, their initial reaction is procedure, it's committees, it's regulations, it's making sure the commission looks good. And really, as I say, I think it's going to become quite a political issue, particularly in those countries that have got elections this year and whose economies have taken quite a battering, just as ours have. Mm. I can't see this existing model of the European Union lasting much longer. It's been in trouble for some time. There's been a great gap between the southern states and the northern states in the European Union. And this COVID crisis, if the populations aren't vaccinated, but the rest of the world manages to move ahead, I think the citizens of the European Union will be up in arms at the failed rollout of this vaccine.
Can you imagine as well, Brendan, if it was the other way around and say the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine was being offered to countries around the world or indeed in Europe, as it has been, and Britain and the British government said, no, 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 you can't send it anywhere else until you've asked our permission.
Oh, we wouldn't hear the end of it. I mean, the wokerati and the Twitterati.
I like that, the wokerati.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
I like it.
They would be up that. In arms. You go, I might put a what's it on that, you know, that thing where you can't sell it on.
Oh, what, an EU export ban.
I'm going to get one of them. No, I mean, they would literally be up in arms. Yeah, over here, all those people that were previously great supporters of the European Union, while they've observed what's gone on, they're not exactly being critical. But if we did it, we'd be imperialists, we'd be racist, we'd be nationalists, and we wouldn't hear the end of it. Mm. Unfortunately, what this has realised to all of us is actually Britain's far better off outside. We're doing our bit, not just to vaccinate our population here in the UK, but we're also helping developing countries and the dependent territories as well, while the European Union is sitting there fat and bloated and not meeting the international standards that we expect of Western democratic countries looking after their citizens.
Absolutely right. Brendan, while I've got you on, let me just ask you about the school situation, because obviously you're active down there in Ashford in Kent. Kent, one of the places that suffered at the hands of the lockdown back in sort of November time, when you suddenly went from tier one to tier three, or tier yes. four, rather. What's the view down there in your part of the world about reopening the schools?
Well, I think we need to get schools reopened as soon as possible. Children have suffered this year in the UK. I think it's 700 million hours have been lost in total for children in schools. Home parenting is a great challenge for those parents who've got to work at the same time as trying to educate their children. And as I think I've discussed on your show previously, when you've got tight, cramped conditions with lots of families and lots of children, it's impossible to learn. They're not getting the education they need. So I think absolutely right. Let's get our children vaccinated if we can, and the teachers. Let's get schools open. I don't see why every school nurse couldn't be responsible for vaccinating the children in the school and getting it done nice and quickly. Most schools have got a school nurse. Mm. We need to get them back. Otherwise, I don't want to be crass about this, we will end up with a generation of delinquents that are behind, that are not able to catch up. And that's not going to help us long term make a success of this country. So get the schools open.
Yes, Brendan, very well said. Couldn't agree more with you. Thank you very much indeed. Brendan Children, CEO of the Independent Business Network there, talking absolute sense, not only about the European Union, but also about the schools. There is now growing pressure on the government to reopen the schools of this country, not least because of the depression, a wave of which is sweeping through our young people, not least because of the crime rates, which are going up because so many young people now are so frustrated by the lockdown that they're taking it out on their fellow citizens. There's so many reasons why we need to find a roadmap out of this particular situation. We've been saying it here at Talk Radio for many weeks. It now looks as though all of the things that we have been saying are being taken up by the government, because they realise in and of themselves that they cannot keep this going indefinitely, that of course it has to to be done in a safe way. But if we have the vaccinations and if we have the ability to make sure that people can be safer, then what on earth is the reason that we cannot reopen the schools and we cannot lift some of the restrictions in place while keeping others which are important to keep? It makes perfect sense to me, and it doesn't mean that you have to completely sell the farm. It doesn't mean that you let rip with the virus. It doesn't mean any of those things. What it does mean is that we actually take a sensible approach, a grown-up approach, one which safeguards not only the health of the nation, but the mental health of our children. This is Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Time to say a very good morning to Dr. Simon Clark. Simon, how are you?
Good morning, Mike. I'm well, thank you.
Excellent.
Yourself?
Yeah, very well. I'm feeling quite optimistic this week, actually, because as much as the numbers of people dying last week when we last spoke were pretty horrendous, they're still bad, but they seem to be reducing. We seem to be seeing evidence that that infection rates appear to be going down as well. What's your sense of it?
Yeah, the day-on-day count of new infections is certainly going down. I think there's perhaps the first evidence, maybe, of death rates, death numbers coming down, although we might just be in the plateau. I suspect the plateau will last for a few days, very least, possibly a week or so. Mm. But it's a good sign anyway. Any slowing down in that increase and any stopping of that increase has to be a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And as more and more people, I mean, 6.5 million vaccines is a pretty impressive number. And as we continue with that march, I mean, there's only one slight fly in the ointment, I suppose, is there is this kind of Pfizer problem of supply, because they're trying to sort of figure out their new kind of manufacturing plant, I think, in Europe. But, you know, there's no reason to suspect that the slowdown needs to be a problem.
No, I wouldn't have thought so. I would think that the government know exactly how many, or more or less, how many doses of each vaccine they're going to have in the UK by the middle of next month. And that's why they set themselves this pretty tall order. But there's nothing wrong with being ambitious. If you think you can fulfil that ambition, then they should go for it. That looks to be what's happening. Fingers crossed they'll pull it off.
Yes. And it's rather distasteful to see the EU playing politics with this, isn't it?
It is, and I think it speaks to a bit of a recognition that their Europe-wide vaccine purchase program hasn't worked as well as they thought it would do. There was a lot back in the summer of fairly smug commentary, if I can put it like that, from some people that the Europeans were doing better buying vaccines, which at that time didn't even exist, than the UK was. Mm. And that's really been turned on its head and shown not to be true. And I think in large part it has perhaps something to do with the fact that they not unreasonably put their eggs into the basket of the Sanofi GSK vaccine, the French vaccine, which the development of which has not gone terribly well. I mean, they're still working on it. They still may get it to work, but it's not gone as swimmingly as others.
Yeah, I was going to ask you actually, Simon, about the different types of vaccines. A friend of mine got a vaccine today and was having a conversation about the whole difference between what each of them does and how they can't really be mixed up and all of that. Can you give a sort of layman's guide to the different vaccines that are going to be available to us?
All right. So the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine, which I think will probably come in about a month's time, maybe a little longer. They are a little chemical messenger. They're actually quite similar in terms of their design, which when you inject it into the muscle cells in your arm, makes those cells produce the virus spike protein. Because the virus spike protein is not something your body normally has, your immune system recognizes it as what we call non-self and generates an immune response to it. So that's direct injection of a chemical messenger to make the protein. Mm. The Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine uses a vaccine from monkeys, which cannot replicate, just causes the cold in monkeys. It's stopped from replicating. That delivers the gene for the spike protein into our muscle cells in a similar way. So again, via a different route, our cells make that spike protein and our immune systems generate a response to it.
Okay, and as far as the kind of the way that they react to the different variants, that's still not really known well. But we're told that the vaccines can be adapted relatively easily.
Yeah, that shouldn't be difficult. I mean, some people have described it as like amending an email. It's not quite that straightforward, and it's not absolutely guaranteed to work. But I would rate the chances as very high. It shouldn't be too much of a problem.
Right. What are you making of the rising sort of chorus of voices now for people to get the vaccine ahead of other people? I mean, it's a big problem for the EU, obviously, because they have to now work out which countries get it, never mind which people in those countries get it. But as far as our kind of decision-making process is concerned, I mean, it seems to me to be sensible to give the vaccine to people who are more exposed to the public, perhaps, than to those who are not.
Well, yeah, you have to balance that up against the risk to people who are in high-risk groups. Mm. While you can say, yes, police officers, for example, may be less likely to die than somebody in an elderly age group, if all your police officers go off sick, you've got a problem for society generally. So that's why the Joint Committee on Vaccines and Immunology exists, to weigh that sort of thing up.
Right. And as far as the new variant that Boris Johnson was speaking about last Friday, when he suggested, apparently wrongly, that it might be more deadly than the original variant, what's the view on that one in the scientific community?
Well, apparently wrongly depends on who you speak to and which newspapers you read. I have to be honest with you, I don't think necessarily we know that it is wrong at this point.
Well, I think the point is that we don't know whether it's any worse.
No, we don't.
And that's therefore wrong, isn't it, to say?
Well, you can take that point of view, yeah. That the government will say, well, we need to tell people about it if there's an issue. I would say that, to be fair to NERVTAG, who advised the government on this, they've not put the chances of it being a problem, a thing, if you like, at any greater than evens.
Right.
But that might just be because the data is not very strong at the moment. It hasn't been around for all that long, or hasn't caused that much of a problem for all that long. Initially, we were told that that it wasn't a problem, that it wasn't more lethal. And that was because we hadn't had experience of it very long. That same study has had a chance to look at that, the infections caused by this variant over a longer period of time, and being able to say, oh, well, hang on, actually, there is possibly a problem here. And if that one's right, it's quite a significant problem. It's a bit like trying to focus a pair of binoculars when you're too close to the subject.
Well, I mean, I think
a bit of distance is useful.
It's a pretty good expression. That's a pretty good way to describe the last year of our lives, I think, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of like through a glass darkly, you know, what happens next? I mean, as far as the quarantine situation is concerned, I was talking to Simon Calder from The Independent a little bit earlier in the show. It looks likely that they might bring that in. Is there any point in doing that now? Because having not done it for the entire year, we're told there's something like 50,000 people coming through Heathrow alone on a weekly basis. I mean, I can see why you would not want that to be happening. But one, I'm not quite sure of the efficacy of now telling people either not to come or just trying to stop it altogether.
The reason behind this, I think, is to try and cut down on the importation of variants of the virus that might cause a problem for the vaccine. And of course, any others that might crop up that we don't know about until they're here. And while it's true to say that they're here already, importing new cases without knowing it, it just makes our life more difficult, just makes it more difficult to keep a lid on those viruses, those strains that will cause an even greater problem.
Mm. But I guess in the end, Simon, if we are told that this new variant is that transmissible, it's so transmissible, then as long as people are actually mingling in any way, like in supermarkets, it's going to be a problem, isn't it?
Well, it can cause a problem, yeah. But the whole point behind this is to reduce the number of interactions between people. Because just because you meet somebody with the virus doesn't mean you're going to get it, doesn't mean you're going to pick it up from, even if you stand right up close to them. But the more times you do that, the greater your risks are.
Sure.
And the same can be said the other way around. The wearing masks, washing hands, keeping distance, all the rest of it, that doesn't make you virus-proof. That doesn't mean you definitely won't pick up the virus. it just reduces your chances.
Because whatever happened, I seem to remember back in the early days of the first lockdown, we were told that in order to get the virus, you had to sort of be in pretty close proximity to someone for 15 minutes or longer in order to sort of get the virus from them. Was that not correct then?
No, I think that's probably still the considered opinion. Mm. However, the new variant may bring that contact time down. I suspect actually it will. And it may mean keeping 2 meters, and some people have even suggested 3, even more important.
Mm. And as far as the whole effect outside of coronavirus into the general health of the population, I know it's not really your area, but a piece in the Times today saying depression among children is at frightening levels, doctors are saying. And we get calls every day, and I talk to parents every day about how their kids are becoming more kind of withdrawn, less outgoing, more anxious. You know, it's a massive problem for the nation, isn't it?
It is. It's a huge problem. It saddens me when people point to lockdown and say they don't work. But it also saddens me when people are overly enthusiastic for lockdowns, which I think some people are.
Yeah.
I consider myself to be a centrist on this. We do have to have regard for all the other factors that that make up the decision that the politicians have to make.
Yes. No, I think that's certainly been my position all the way through, that, you know, of course, you want to safeguard the health of people who might die from coronavirus, but at the same time, you can't ignore regarded as collateral damage to the society either.
Absolutely. I'd agree with that entirely.
Yeah, thank you. Simon, as far as the kind of the next stage is concerned, I mean, if we continue to see numbers falling, what would that tell you? Because I know the government has said what they'd like to do is when they next lift this lockdown, they don't particularly want to have to go back and do another one. Presumably that will be helped by the time of year, by the warmth of the days and the sunshine and all the rest of it. But I mean, can you see that February could be a bit of a turning point?
I think February will start to get things under control, but the number, the amount of virus circulating the population is still going to be quite high. I don't think it will be driven down that much. I think it will be March before they start to really look at being able to lift things, lift restrictions.
And I mean, as far as the whole situation goes with the new, we're going to have 3 vaccines pretty much very soon. And you and I have talked about this before. I think you've said 70%. In terms of the herd immunity figure that you'd like to reach. What's your understanding of how many people have now been infected in the country with coronavirus?
Oh, you've got me there. It's about 15 to 20%, I think.
Right.
So we're still some
15 to 20% of 60 million.
But we don't know how long that's lasted for, though.
That's quite a big number, though, isn't it?
It is a big number, yeah, but there is evidence that people who've got infected in the first wave, their immunity is waning.
Mm.
We don't know how high, if you like, that immunity has to be. We just don't know about that.
Mm.
And of course, when people talk about so many percent of the population need to be vaccinated, what they actually mean is that so many percent of the population need to be immune, and we know that none of these vaccines are 100% effective. They never are.
No, of course. Dr. Simon Clark, great to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Virology expert, microbiologist at the University of Reading. Very sensible point of view on this as well, because I think the more sense that we get out there from this particular show, from this particular radio station, the better, because what we need are people like Simon to say, look, yes, we need to safeguard the population, but let's not forget about the rest of the population who are being damaged by this, not least the youngsters who can't go to school, the teenagers who have no hope of what they're going to be doing in the future, the people who are unable to operate their businesses because they've been shut down by the government, the people who we call the forgotten, the freelancers who have been left outside of the kind of furlough system, the people who would like to be able to start up new businesses but are unable to do so, the people who are being made unemployed because of this lockdown and because of this terrible reaction by the government economically and physically as well.
Hold up. Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Time to say a very good afternoon to Roger Layton. Roger, hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Excellent. I know you are very much at the forefront of the education business. You're at the sharp end of it, as we say. You, I know, have organised an awful lot of the home schooling and the home learning that's going on at the moment. But it's been going on for a long time, Roger, and I think it's now becoming clear that it's no substitute for having schools open as usual.
It really isn't. Schools have got much better at this as the months have gone on. They're really well organised. They know how to deliver the best possible education online. But it's never going to be the same as face-to-face, is it?
No.
Same with meetings. You know, we all know a meeting online is never the same. You don't get the body language. You don't get the interaction. You don't get the immediate response that you get face-to-face.
No, exactly right. So what's the answer then, Roger? Because clearly, you know, the Prime Minister wishes to reopen the schools. Obviously, there's scientific evidence against him being able to do that now. But I mean, listening to some of the arguments from both sides, it seems to me that there are some who are so cautious that they would never actually reopen schools as long as there's a risk that, that kids might either get the infection or might pass the infection on. And I don't think there's ever going to be a point at which we can guarantee that's not going to happen.
No, and I think we need to take a measured risk-based approach to this. We've got to balance the risks that are inherent of kids being at home and not in school against the risks of them coming into school. I think probably the scientific evidence is moving towards saying that younger children, primary age children, ought to be able to come back earlier than the older ones. And they obviously are the ones who have the most difficulty sometimes dealing with online learning.
Yeah.
So I think there is an argument to say if the scientific evidence is showing that the younger ones can come back, let's do that as soon as we can. Maybe after half term, certainly before Easter, we possibly could.
Right. I mean, certainly, I mean, we speak to people, as I say, all the time about their troubles and travails at home. And one of our regular contributors, actually, has got two primary school age children. And she's basically been in touch with the school and said, look, I can't do the homeschooling with them anymore because she has to work from home. She has to supervise both of them. And despite the fact that, you know, they get set work, they're not of an age to be left completely on their own to do it. You know, so it's very difficult for a lot of people.
I totally agree. Look, my wife is downstairs with a 9-year-old
right.
trying to
so
do her work.
So you've escaped to get on the radio.
Yeah.
Well done.
Next. I do my share.
Of course you do.
I know exactly what you say.
No, it's very, I mean, it's very tough. I mean, I've got two teenage boys and they really are pretty well behaved when it comes to doing the work, but they don't always do it in the way that I suppose they should. They don't always dedicate themselves to, you know, they're not getting up at the same time in the morning. They're not getting dressed in the same way as they would if they were going to school. And also more damaging, I think, is not so much the academic side, but just the social side of seeing their mates, you know, and seeing their friends and doing things together that teenagers do.
Yes. And all the extracurricular activities that go on in school, the sport.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a particularly important one. You know, that most kids now are not going to be getting much exercise, are they? And no. that you know, that's not a problem for a few weeks, but it's now, you know, for many almost a whole year, isn't it?
Right.
That's going to take its toll as well. So you're right, there's a whole range of things outside the classroom that they're missing out on.
Yeah, and I always like to know from your side, Roger, what the teachers are saying, because we hear again from a lot of teachers, and many of them say, look, we'd rather be back at work, we want to be back at work, we don't wish to be prevented from going back to work, so just show us where we can be as safe as possible, show us what the precautions could be that we're not doing, that we could do more of. But also, I'm looking in the Times today about teachers who are not at greater risk from the virus, right? So like social care workers and nurses are at very high risk, but teachers aren't really.
Yeah, I think that varies hugely depending on what type of children you're dealing with. For instance, if you're in a special school, you're almost dealing in the same way as a medical professional or a social care worker would with these special needs children. Right. If you're dealing with sixth formers, yeah, you can distance yourself. It's a lot easier to deal with. So I think it varies from phase to phase. Look, the best thing that could happen on that side would be to get teachers vaccinated, wouldn't it?
Well, that's what I think, But then, of course, there are certain people in certain unions who say, oh, well, that doesn't protect them any more than if they weren't vaccinated, which is a slightly nebulous argument, as far as I'm concerned, because it does.
I've not heard that one.
Oh, yeah. Because the problem with the vaccine is it doesn't stop you from getting the virus. It doesn't stop you from transmitting the virus. However, it does protect you somewhat from getting a very serious dose of the virus. So the argument from those who would make it is that, you know, that won't prevent the spread of the disease if schools are spreading it.
I can see that, and there is that whole argument that it's not so much that the children are spreading it, it's the fact that all the movement and traffic involved in schools being open, you know, parents at the gate, deliveries, all those sorts of things add to the spread, not necessarily the children themselves taking it home. So there is an argument on that side.
Right.
But look, it comes back to what we said earlier, that there needs to be a balanced risk approach to this, doesn't it? There's no perfect answer, is there?
No.
There's no easy way forward. We're going to have to take some risks one way or the other.
I think so.
And I think it as long as it can be shown that there's not going to be any adding to the impact on the NHS, which is the fundamental, you know, bedrock of everything we're doing here, keep the NHS safe, then I think we should start looking at getting those younger ones back as soon as possible.
But I wonder as well, Roger, if in fact the reasoning for the lockdown is and has quite often been mooted as such is safeguarding of the NHS. You know, you need to weigh that up surely with the mental health of our nation's children, because it suddenly looks a lot more complicated if you compare those two things. You know, it's one thing to say, look, we can all give up going to the pub for a while, we can all give up going out for a while, we can all stop going on holidays for a while, but you can't suddenly say that something as negative as this psychological effect on kids versus the protection of the NHS. Suddenly it's a different conversation, isn't it?
Yes, look, I agree. However, there's the reality of the fact that the immediate pressure is patients turning up who can't breathe and are going to die if they don't get oxygen, as opposed to, the slow burn, you might say, of mental health and well-being.
Yes.
So if we can get over that hump of the patients turning up at the door struggling to breathe, then, you know, then we should quickly as possible be taking account, as you say, the mental health aspects.
Yes. And what about what the next step should be, Roger? I mean, would you favour, for example, the government looking at specific areas maybe and doing it that way, so that if you were in somewhere like Cornwall and there was a very low infection rate of COVID, you could open the schools there? You know, if on the other hand, in East London, it was very high, you wouldn't.
Yeah, and I think that we need a nuanced approach in general. So, and I think a lot of this will be putting responsibility down to school level or academy trusts like ours level. Mm. So I think it should be regionally based. I think that's very sensible, because that comes back to, is it safe to open the schools without overburdening the NHS?
Yeah.
I think it should be phased according to the age of the children, because all the evidence shows that children, younger children, are less likely to spread the disease. Mm. And then I think schools should be given the option, for instance, to work on a rota basis with the older children, so that everybody gets some face-to-face time. without overburdening the staff and the building with too many children at the same time. Mm. Up to now, the government has been very rigid, saying, no, when we do reopen, you can't have any rotas. It's got to be full reopening.
Right.
I think we need a more sensitive approach to this.
And who's responsible for that sort of policy? Because that did seem a bit boneheaded, doesn't it? Because you can't have a one-size-fits-all in these situations.
Well, there has been a one-size-fits-all laid down by the Department for Education so far. Mm. That's got to change.
Yes, really absolutely. Has. I mean, amazing to see another story in the papers today about private tutoring, that some frazzled parents are spending up to £1,500 a week on private tutors. I can't imagine that's a very big number of people doing that, because who can afford to spend that kind of money? But certainly there are parents who are concerned about what happens at the end of this academic year to the exams, because we still don't really know whether there are going to be exams, and if there aren't, how the grades are going to be arrived at.
True, and I can imagine parents, particularly, as you say, of kids who are coming up towards exams, panicking a bit and thinking, what can we do? I would say it really shouldn't be necessary to spend that sort of money, because schools are particularly focused on those age groups that are about to do their exams. Mm. And they are doing everything they possibly can to still prepare them for we don't know what in terms of assessments and tests. It's looking as if there will be some reduced level exams, assessment tasks of some description. It won't just be left to teacher assessment grades like it was last year.
Mm, okay. Well, let's hope they don't go too near those algorithms either, which didn't seem to work terribly well. What about the schools that you're opening at the moment? Because last time we spoke, Roger, you said that there were a lot more children actually in school, key workers' children, mm-hmm. Vulnerable mm-hmm. children as well. Have you spotted any incidences of coronavirus? Has there been much of that going on, much infection?
Hardly any. We have been carrying out mass, I call it mass, but the numbers are fairly small, but it's known as mass testing, using the lateral flow tests,
right.
For children who are actually in school. Mm. The number who tested positive has been tiny, maybe one or two out of 100, yeah. 150. Pupils.
That's interesting.
But that's still useful, because it means that those pupils can go and isolate and not infect the rest. Sure. So that's been helpful.
No, that has been helpful, I'm sure. But it's interesting, isn't it, that the levels are that low, considering what we're told about this more a transmissible variant virus, which apparently is supposedly going everywhere.
Well, the only thing I'd say there, Mike, is that's using the lateral flow test. And the lateral flow test, that was the one that was piloted in Liverpool, only picks up high viral loads.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily the case that is picking up all the pupils who've got any form of the infection.
Yes, but I think that's good, though, isn't it? Because unfortunately, yes. I mean, otherwise you'll end up being like Sir Keir Starmer. You can self-isolate every 5 minutes because you've come into contact with somebody who supposedly had a positive test, even though there might not be anything wrong with them.
Certainly, this does pick up those who are most likely to infect others. Mm. Yes. And we found that really useful.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's the
testing has got to be part of the way forward.
Yes.
Vaccinate the teachers, give schools enough tests to be able to test pupils as they come into school.
Yeah. How disruptive is that to your school day, though, if you're doing it to an entire school?
Well, you couldn't do it on a regular basis. It is being done twice weekly with the pupils we have in school, but that's very small numbers.
Yeah.
So that can be done. You're right. Once schools are back in full flow, then that won't be possible. Which brings me back to, let's look at rotas, having smaller numbers on site at any one time and sharing out face-to-face time rather than having all or nothing.
Yeah.
We could then do the testing.
Sounds like you should be busting down Gavin Williamson's door, giving him some advice.
Our professional associations are doing that on a daily basis, I assure you.
Glad to hear it. Roger, good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Roger Layton, Chief Executive of Partnership Learning Academy Trust here in London. Isn't it interesting that they use that lateral flow test? One out of 150 kids, and absolutely no massive infection rates going on, despite the fact that many of the schools that Roger certainly runs are still open, because they're teaching kids from vulnerable families, but also teaching kids from key workers' families as well. There's definitely got to be an argument about opening the schools carefully, precisely, and with some nuance, so that you don't just say everything opens and everybody has to deal with it and everybody's back on the bus and everybody's back on the tube. No, do it sensibly. You know, this can't be beyond the wit of man, can it?
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. Now, we've had one or two little brushes with social media in this organisation. Here at Talk Radio, of course, we famously had a little spat with YouTube, which seems to now have been resolved. They've taken down our channel before we had it reinstated. There's now a kind of growing call for some form of censorship on social media, which has seemingly set the cat amongst the pigeons. But leading the charge, you might find it slightly surprising to know, are the Duke and Duchess of Netflix, no less, Meghan and Harry, who have basically said that they would like to somehow control what it is that people are allowed to say on social media. Well, I'd have one question for them. What the hell's it got to do with you? Let's talk to Emma Webb, Deputy Research Director at the Free Speech Union, Associate Fellow at Civitas. She's written a piece for Spiked Online about this. Emma, a very good afternoon to you. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. They do make a rather odd couple in all sorts of ways, don't they? The Duke and Duchess of Netflix, as we like to call them. You know, what on earth are they thinking, representing, and who do they think they represent in this kind of quest to silence people?
Yeah, so they said last year that they famously wanted to carve out this new progressive role for themselves. And one of the ways that they said that they wanted to do this was by eliminating online bullying and hate speech. Before last year, one of the first things that they did was they tacked themselves onto this hashtag Stop Hate for Profit campaign,
right,
which was a sort of social media boycott, mainly against Facebook, making certain demands about the content that they would put up, demanding they get rid of misinformation, and so almost demanding that they create this sort of woke corporate infrastructure where experts would evaluate their policies and whether or not certain content had the potential to cause hate. And so now what they've done with their horrifically named Archiewell Foundation, using their son to forward their woke agenda. So now the Archiewell Foundation has partnered with a department in UCLA, University of California, and it's a center called the Center for Critical Internet Inquiry. And this is run by a bunch of two woke, I suppose you would call them woke, critical theorists, who one of them wrote a book called Algorithms of Oppression. And it's all about how Google is racist, how the algorithms perpetuate racism, discrimination on the basis of sex, race, and so on.
Yeah, it's one of those things, isn't it?
Now Archiewell have officially partnered with them.
It's one of those things, isn't it, that people talk about. I mean, I found myself in some kind of bizarre left-wing sort of debating chamber one day last week, where they were debating about reparations to people historically and who should get reparation money and when it should be paid to them and who should be responsible for paying. I thought to myself, you know, there are entire swathes of the world now talking about stuff that most people don't actually give a stuff about, you know. And this is another one, algorithms of what was it? Algorithms of hate or something. I mean, you know,
algorithms of oppression.
Yeah. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's you know, these people don't have enough to do, clearly.
It's also completely inappropriate for Harry. He is a prince, however much he removes himself. Mm. And of course, he's sort of he's almost as if he's wearing his sort of soldier's khaki with a high-vis jacket on top. He really wants to be out of the limelight, but is desperate to constantly remain relevant. And it's totally inappropriate for a prince to be pushing what is essentially a political agenda, and also particularly because one of the founders of this internet center that they're partnering with the founders had co-authored a paper with a UN special rapporteur that had suggested that the UN should be coordinating internet censorship. So the big tech companies' practices should be coordinated by the UN. He is involving himself not so much in domestic politics, but in international politics in a way that is completely inappropriate for a member of any royal family to be doing.
Of course.
And also, I think he would find that the majority of the British public not only would think that it's inappropriate for him to be trying to censorship the masses, which is an extremely elitist thing to attempt to do, as well as the fact that he shouldn't be involving himself with this critical theory ideology.
No, I mean, this is the problem, isn't it, for him? Because at the end of the day, he's having to side with these various organisations, which are inevitably politically driven. It's not about censorship of all nasty people. It's about censorship of nasty people on one side of the argument. You know, like, they're all very much excitable about banning Donald Trump from Twitter, but they're not so keen on Antifa being banned. And when they hear about that, suddenly it's all terrible. I mean, I was reading a story today that Facebook have now signed up with a load of a contract with a load of media publishers in this country in order to sort of try and escape being sanctioned by the government. But believe it or not, they've gone into bed with all sorts of news providers, including The Guardian, The Financial Times, and Sky News. You know, and you just go, well, you know where that's going, don't you?
Yeah, it feels as if following all of the stuff that happened with big tech and their anti-competitive behaviour, trying to prevent even the alternatives in the form of Parler from operating, that they sort of are chasing everybody off of their platforms that they don't agree with, and then denying them the possibility of accessing social media elsewhere at a time when everybody is locked inside. And for all of these large corporates, and now for a prince and his wife to be using their position to try to censor people that they disagree with on the basis of an ideology that is disputed and shouldn't just be accepted as if it's somehow politically neutral. I that goes beyond winding up normal people. I think that this is a serious crisis for free speech, and it poses a significant threat.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's, I suppose, where this conversation ends up, doesn't it? How do you control people who have seemingly no controls other than the ones that they put on themselves? You know, because you look at YouTube, you look at Facebook, you look at Twitter. You know, basically, these are run by very successful individuals who are as flawed as any other individual, presumably, but who make policy based on a whim and what they think they want to see and what they think they want to hear. And they clearly do not take the view that everybody is equal.
There's a serious problem, I think, with these large corporates, and it is perfectly epitomised in Harry and Meghan's involvement. As you say, that they're not accountable. No. It poses an obvious threat to democracy, because there's nothing that can be done to stop these people who have an inordinate amount of power to control the sorts of information that we can access and the sorts of things that we're allowed to think. And this has a direct impact on things like our right to a freedom of conscience, because if they want the UN or the Archiewell Foundation or the powers that be internationally to dictate really what sorts of information we can even consider when making our own minds up about these things. Mm. And that's completely inappropriate.
And it betrays a certain arrogance as well, doesn't it? That they believe themselves to be so righteous and so right about everything that only they can judge which horrible, nasty people should be stopped from saying whatever it is that they want to say. And what I find extraordinary is that Harry just sees no irony whatsoever in pointing out the privilege of people, when he perhaps is one of the most privileged people, one of the top 10 most privileged people in the entire world.
God forbid that we should accuse Harry and Meghan of hubris. but it has become it's become almost an ongoing joke that every now and then they come out with one of these slightly sickly videos lamenting their own position in the world, in a way that is completely unrelatable for others. And there's a kind of paternalistic element to this, that they seem to be entirely lacking self-awareness, that they are behaving paternalistically in a way that, and I personally speaking, I'm a monarchist, and I can see the arguments from the other side against the monarchy because of the sorts of things that they're doing. That it goes beyond issues simply to do with free speech to complicated international and domestic politics. I don't think that they really understand exactly what they're getting themselves involved in here and what they're meddling with and what the implications of this are. I think they potentially think that they're just being nice and trying to do good in the world. And I don't have the necessarily the breadth of knowledge or the vision to see exactly what the negative implications of that are on normal people.
I take a much less charitable view than you on this, Emma. I think that they know exactly what they're doing, and I think it's purely about making money, because there's a lot of money in the wokerati out there. There's a lot of money in being the front man and the front woman for a movement for change, because it makes you sound like a really good person, you know, because anybody who doesn't want to change anything obviously is an absolute and utter ghastly individual. And that's now the narrative. But, you know, I'm interested in how you go from being a relatively unknown actress and a relatively well-known prince to becoming these kind of culture warriors. I mean, I think it can only be a very deliberate move to try and, you know, monetize, you know, wokeism.
Well, it does seem that there is a lot of money and financial incentive for some of these big companies to, you know, jump on the censorship bandwagon. All of them are doing it, and it's something that we've been seeing for a long time in with large corporates attaching themselves onto particular political causes and lobbying. So it's no surprise that in almost setting themselves up as the prince and princess across the water, that they're, and particularly given Meghan's views that she's expressed before, you know, having managed to achieve such an enormous platform as a princess, and now they have freed themselves from having to do any of the duties that a royal would be expected to do, and can focus entirely on their own self-promotion. And unfortunately, that self-promotion seems to be at the detriment of freedom of speech and freedom of conscience.
Yes, it's never stopped either. Emma, it's a great article. Find it on Spiked Online. Emma Webb there talking to us from the Free Speech Union, Deputy Research Director, also Associate Fellow at Civitas. I mean, it really is quite extraordinary. And this is why I have always targeted Harry and Meghan, not just because of their ridiculousness, not just because of their pomposity, but because if you allow people like them to somehow think they've got a foothold in how society is framed, they will take that foothold and they will keep climbing up it until such time as they think they're in charge. And then they think they can tell you what to do. And there's enough people telling us what to do already without Harry and Meghan joining the particular cause, isn't there?
Talk radio across the UK, online, on DAB and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday, on Talk Radio via DAB online or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration. And Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said, done.